One, two, three, four.
How can we design and adapt for the uncertainties of the 21st century? How do emotions shape our decisions and the way we design the world around us?
Scott Dorley is the creative director at Stanford's D School and co-author of Make Space. He teaches design communication, and his work has been featured in museums and architecture and urbanism and the New York Times. And Carissa Carter is the academic director at Stanford's D School and author of The Secret Language of Maps. She teaches courses on emerging technologies and data visualization and received Fast Company and Core 77 awards for her work on designing with machine learning and blockchain. Together, they co-authored Assembling Tomorrow, a guide to designing a thriving future.
Scott Dorley and Carissa Carter, welcome to the Creative Process and One Planet podcast.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You both teach at universities at a time when educational silos are in flux and young people are living in this kind of giant laboratory of possibilities, innovation and experimentation. And things around us are changing so much, so fast. The rapid advances of AI is challenging, you know, many norms. And Assembling Tomorrow really helps us put it into context, as well as being, you know, it's playful and imaginative and really thought-provoking and inspired me to consider what's the future that I want to live in and how can I be a part of that design process. So what made you write Assembling Tomorrow at this moment in time?
I mean, Scott and I are both educators and designers and writers of other things in the world. And we know that as people that teach other people how to make things and launch them, that this moment feels really overwhelming. Like, we're overwhelmed with the technology, our climate's on the fritz, and it can feel really unsettling. Yet at the same time, as people that craft learning experiences, we know how much agency each of us has as individuals. And so we wanted to write the book to call attention to the complexity and the feeling of overwhelm of this moment, and then also to share things that anybody can do to launch ourselves into that better future.
As Chris was saying, it just feels like we're in one of these moments, and we really wanted to understand all the technology, all the limits that we're running up against, like climate change and political polarization.
I mean, we have a very expansive view as to what design is. We think it's everything from physical products and digital products that people make and all of the graphics, et cetera, embedded within them, but all the way expanded out to what are the experiences that those products make.
Exactly. And you bring it beyond what we traditionally think about as design. I think climate change, we think a lot about we have to design a better tomorrow. But yes, it's beyond just say politics. We can design better electoral systems.
You really open it up in literally every way. Every technology system we use can be redesigned to better meet the needs and experiences of people and the planet. So just to touch upon the many interesting solutions and design thinking in the book, I believe you've selected a passage to share with our listeners.
Yes, I did. It's the introduction, and it's called On the Verge. It opens up the quote, which is this: "It may be that what we have is a world not on the verge of flying apart, but an uncreated one, still in shapeless fragments, waiting to be put together properly." And that's from Catherine Ann Porter, an article called "The Future Is Now" from Mademoiselle magazine in 1950. 70 years from tomorrow will be a special day. Someone will feel the immense pressure of progress and be paralyzed by possibility. Someone will rekindle a species. Someone will regret the impact of what they've put into the world. Someone will confuse code for consciousness. On this day, your youngest grandchild will unbox their first tabletop nuclear fusion generator. The instruction book will be more than 3 centimeters thick, not because it's complicated to run a nuclear fusion generator at home, but because there are at least 50 warnings in as many different languages. Do not disassemble. Do not link with additional generators. Not for use by children under 6. Use of nuclear fusion to harm others will result in prosecution. The generator itself will weigh no more than a carton of milk. Something so powerful should weigh more, they will think. But the instruction book, rather, the warning book, will have a respectable heft. A lot could go wrong. Even more could go right. A lot could go wrong even when everything goes right. To be a maker in that moment, 70 years from tomorrow, will be to shape the world, to craft new possibilities, and repair mistakes using the pieces that have come before. 70 years ago yesterday was its own special day. On that day, someone broke ground on a radiant city of tall, evenly spaced high-rise buildings, hoping to solve the social problems of the era. Someone imagined a network of data spanning the globe, all accessible right from your desk. Someone questioned their role in building a bomb. Someone implanted an electric pacemaker on a human heart for the first time. On that day, someone sketched out the designs for a giant plane that would bring people together around the globe. That plane would bring world peace as cultures mixed and mingled, or so they hoped. Also, larger planes would mean the airline could sell more seats. The plans for the plane were drawn by hand with pencil lead, set squares, and steel rules. And the finished plane would emit more carbon dioxide than almost any other plane on the planet. To be a maker in that moment, 70 years ago yesterday, was to rebuild the world itself, to make big changes in a world that had previously been making us instead. By then, humankind had already made the move from what design philosophers Ann Pendleton Julian and John Seely Brown call working in the world to working on the world. The things people made were no longer sitting tidily within the bounds of nature and society, but were actively altering both on a grand scale. Today, too, is a special day. Today, someone is putting the finishing touches on a machine learning algorithm that will change the way you relate to your family. Someone is trying to design a way to communicate with animals in their own language. Someone is designing a gene that alters bacteria to turn your poop bright blue when it's time to see the doctor. Someone is cleaning up the mess someone else left behind 70 years ago yesterday. Today, someone has just had an idea that will end up saving one thing while it harms another. All days are special in their own ways, but we happen to live in a time of quickening history when what has been brewing for years coalesces overnight. We live in a time that defines the line between before and after. Today is an era of runaway design, in which the things people make, whether they be everyday products, hybrid workspaces, viral media posts, recycling systems, gene therapies, artificial intelligence bots, nuclear fusion generators, or anything in between, tangle with our environment and emotions in unpredictable ways. Our byproducts modify the biosphere, and our data sets drive decisions, making the impacts of our actions hard to anticipate, notice, and repair. We live in a moment when the materials of making are blurring the lines between people, technology, and the natural world. Technology is getting more human-like as computers take on the task of thinking for us and themselves. Nature is merging with technology as line-editing DNA bases becomes an everyday occurrence. Meanwhile, our minds and media are so intertwined and entangled that it's making our nervous systems nervous. These things, the quickening, the tangled upness, and the shifting roles of materials and machines, are the ingredients that make today special, fraught, and full of potential. To be a maker in this moment, to be human today, is to collaborate with the world. It is to create and be created, to work and be worked on, to make and be made. To be human is to tinker, create, fix, care, and bring new things into the world. It is to design. You, yes, you, might design products or policies, services or sermons, production lines or preschool programs. You might run a business, make art, or participate in passing out meals to the poor. You might write code or pour concrete, lobby for endangered species legislation, or craft cocktails. Wherever you fit in, you are part of shaping the world. This is design work.
I love that you lay out all the things that are happening at this moment and show how design affects every aspect of our lives and all the possibilities that it spreads out before us. And the book really encompasses so much and expresses that we can all be empowered to be good designers and not just passive passengers. And it's actually such an exciting and yet uncertain time to be in. Many of our educational institutional systems seem to be dated and broken to some degree. And we have these new tools with technology being developed and rushed out to assist us. And some say that we can be more than just human. We can enhance our intelligence and have these so-called superpowers to do more, faster, better. But this efficiency is in and of itself a danger. I hope that we can move past this era of move fast and break things. And as you advocate for in the book, we need to really question this thinking behind move fast and break things, and perhaps to be just a little bit more thoughtful about the technologies and designs that we put into the world.
I know that each year at the Hasno-Plattner Institute of Design at Stanford, over 1,000 students attend your classes, workshops, and programs to learn the thinking behind design and help
unlock their creative potential.
You mentioned many of those wonderful design possibilities that are happening today or on the horizon. What do you feel are some of the skills needed for students in the 21st century? What are you teaching besides agility, critical thinking, intuitive intelligence? How can we become more multilingual designers to adapt, to prepare for those uncertain futures?
That's a really fantastic question and something that we think about all the time. I would say it falls into two separate categories. One is, how do you decide what to put into the world? And the other is, as you're creating, as you're trying to contribute to the world, how do you figure out what's working and what's not? So on the first, it's really a question of desirability. Design is so much about desirability. What do we want to have in the world? It's not just about technology, which is about what's possible. It's not, say, about business, which is about what's viable, what can you, you know, sustain in the world. It's really about what are the things that are going to be useful to people, that are going to be aesthetically appealing, and frankly, that are going to be worthwhile to have in the world. So there's a lot of work to understand, what do I value? What's going to be useful? And how do the things that I create change the circumstances they enter in? And that brings up the second thing, which is, once you create something, how do you understand how it's working in the world? Design is about not just thinking and not just deciding for yourself, but testing things out to see if they work or not. And you have to do that in a way that's both safe for you in terms of, like, not too much emotional investment, and then also is safe for the world. So you want to test things before they get out into a position where they can cause harm. So you want to test early and often so you can learn as much as possible before you put something out into the world.
Yeah, and so often we get excited by an idea just because you can make it, but then should it be in the world?
We have to ask ourselves, as we've seen with the free reign of social media and what that's done to a whole generation, and again, our political and electoral landscape, not to mention the fact that the world's fossil fuels took 300 million years to form, and we have almost depleted them in less than 200 years. So everyone today says they're going green, but is that green as in money? 2023, as you know, was Earth's warmest year since modern record keeping began, and we're continuing to experience in 2024. And you also addressed in the book that design begins with feelings. And I find that interesting because I guess when I was growing up, I often thought of design as being the products, the things that are created when the emotions are taken out. I grew up thinking design was related to function, but there is this emotional connection we have to what we design. There is this emotional connection to the designs that we create and adopt.
Can too many feelings be involved in the design process? How do we become emotionally intelligent as designers?
There's some really wonderful research from a man at USC named Antonio Damasio, who studies how people make decisions. Emotions are the trigger for decisions. Emotions are the things that motivate us. They force us to notice things or pay attention to one thing and not something else. And they also really trigger our decision-making process. So for students, I think it's extremely important that they understand the role that emotions play. And then they're able to acknowledge that they have emotions and notice them as they come in, and also develop tools to be able to deal with emotions as they come. You probably don't want a decision to be just guided completely by a knee-jerk reaction. If you're making a decision, you want to be in a place where you're calm and you can make a good decision. I think about that all the time in my life. When I'm not calm, I tend to eat things that aren't healthy for me. I tend to make decisions that might not be good for me. And the thing is that in design for a long time, emotions weren't taken into account at the level that they could be. So if you look at the internet and the creation of the internet, the idea was to move information quickly. And that's great, and that has been great, but there have been a lot of things where they didn't take into account the fact that, well, there are people attached to all that information, and those people are experiencing emotions, and the things that we're designing are actually exciting and aggravating our emotions. And so you take something like social media, which is really about the speedy spread of information, and what you see is it also brought along with it, you know, teen depression and body image issues and political polarization. And that's because we're also connecting all these emotions together.
Yes, it's so important that we adapt and evolve our designs to factor in the ways they are being used and misused and how some designs depart from their initial purpose.
And Carissa, your work at the Stanford D School, you teach courses on the intersection of data and design and how do you interpret feelings in your analysis? And, you know, a lot of data goes over people's heads. And I've interviewed many of the IPCC lead authors, and many of them say that the facts speak for themselves. But we know that that's not always the case. You have to speak for them. So I'm just wondering what that process of telling stories through data is for you to show people why they should listen and why things are related to people's lives so they can engage in a meaningful way.
Yeah, we talk about every single data visualization or story that incorporates data having three elements in a tug of war with each other. And those three elements are the data. So what is that information? They're the bias, which is the bias of the person creating that data story. And that bias doesn't necessarily have to be a negative thing. It's their point of view. And the craft. So data, bias, and craft are in constant push and pull with each other. And the craft is how it's made, what it looks like. So when you're asking me about feelings, I'm thinking, again, the bias of the person that created that data story is always embedded in that work. Whether they have created that infographic to get their agenda across, like they have a goal, or they're just trying to present a bunch of information, right? Like that in itself is an agenda to like not have one, to allow people to just explore it on their own. You always have to consider like, what is the worldview, the bias of the people that you're presenting information to? Because those things are, you know, the creator and the receiver aren't always in harmony with each other in terms of what their points of view are. And you know, depending on what data is included or not included and how you are creating that infographic, what it looks like down to the color palette and the context that it's used, all of those elements are intertwined.
Yes. Well, I'm very much for using whatever you can to impart why we should do more to mitigate climate change, adapt to a 2-degree world. So I don't mind a little bit of a bias on this. I think that's positive. So what ways specifically are you using data visualization and narrative to explain climate change, perhaps for those who just aren't not on board, you're just obstinate, stubborn, or feels like it's going to sort itself out? How do you tell those stories?
Well, one thing to know is that every single climate visualization that we see out in the world, whether that is a map of rising temperatures around the country, around the globe, or rising sea level or wildfire, like all of that has design decisions behind it. I am also with you that we need to get more people understanding the impacts of their own actions on climate change and being aware of what's happening to the planet. So one is to be able to interpret that work and really interrogate it for what it is. So to be able to read any infographic and what we call deconstruct it, understand like what emotions is it evoking in you, gut reaction, why those are happening, and like literally what has the designer done to make you feel that way. So that literacy in reading infographics is one piece. And then to give you very specific examples, in one of the classes that I teach and co-teach with a geoscientist, Kate Maher, and an infographic designer, Catherine Madden, we have students visualize what is known as the climate swerve. So this idea that humans have agency over shifting climate, it was coined the climate swerve by Jay Lufton a number of years ago. And that concept is one that the more that we have people both sourcing what is the information and how to present it, that we feel gets that climate literacy in our brains and gets that message across. And you can see it in really interesting ways. So like, for example, we have students visualize climate anxiety. And where is that cropping up overlaid with like, where should people feel anxious about climate? We even had a student group that visualized the themes of major Marvel movies throughout the past 20 plus years looked at what those themes were and how they change and how a lot of the themes have started to be much more climate related, kind of showing how these topics are ingrained in popular culture too.
Yes, I think it's waking us all up. And I did have the opportunity to interview Douglas Woke, who read all the Marvel superhero comics. It's 27,000 comics, quite a task. They address climate change and many important issues of our times, like populism and the rise of autocracy. And you, of course, also featured sci-fi stories in Assembling Tomorrow. Do you feel these stories increase awareness, but do you feel it at the same time heightens it or makes it unreal? Do you feel these stories inspire people to take action?
I think it makes it more real, right? Because if we only all speak science to each other, like, that's not going to work. That's just one language. We need to be translating these themes of climate into whatever it is that moves people. And if that's movies, fantastic.
Also, just like the stories that you shared in your book, it helps people who might not be scientifically minded. You said sometimes it's hard when you talk about things like, oh, the circular economy or how we're going to reach net zero. At least we can see it. Now, even with people who have problems with AI consuming a lot of energy, but it helps us visualize some of those difficult transitions that needs to take place in terms of transport and industry and so many things. So Scott and Chris, we're living in the center of the city and we hear so much about innovation and smart cities, but people still don't know what their future is going to look like. Scott, you mentioned many of those innovations that are coming down the line. I'm thinking about the heat dome that's been hanging over 27 states in the U.S. for weeks, and not to mention the flooding, wildfires, or drought. So what do you envisage for our future cities? What narratives do we need to get the message across when it comes to housing, green spaces, transport, waste management, all these areas, the adaptation efforts that need to take place, and the good design thinking that can help us move it along?
I think one of the things we talk about in the book is aiming for imperfection. Right. So I think we have a bit of a bias towards sort of utopian visions or dystopian visions, right? Like, it's either going to go completely south or we're going to get it just right. And particularly with urban planning, actually, there's a long history of people creating utopian visions. The one for me that stands out a lot was called a bunch of different things, but the Radiant City was one of the ways to talk about it. And this is sets of high-rise buildings surrounded by green space. And then that was a lot of the thinking that went into like large-scale housing project development in the 60s and 70s. And it was based on, well, we need more green space in the cities. And that's a great impulse. Right. And so why don't we, you know, build more dense housing and then we can have more green space. But you get into when in the reality of that day-to-day, you start to understand that like, well, somebody living on the 20th floor, if they want their kids to play outside, can't watch their kids from the 20th floor. So to get down, everybody has to go down and you have to take the kids outside. It also kind of like gives you, even though you have more access to green space, you're kind of like in this little box. So it doesn't give you real access to the green space. So as they built these things, they started to realize that that model wasn't really working, right? So the main thing is, and they're just like, you know, development after development like that, where we have this kind of utopian theory that we try to create, and then it kind of breaks down when you put it into the use. Now, that's not to say that there isn't something in there that can be put to use. I think high-density housing is really useful, particularly when it comes to climate, different ways to do it, right, where you might have more access to the outdoors. So one thing is to just like not really try to get it perfect, but try to create something where when we don't get it perfect, which we will not because we're not omniscient beings, then be able to adapt. You know, like, so let's build something that's a little bit adaptable when we don't get it quite right. You know, not something that's like really just going to be sort of set in stone and is very difficult to change, because we're going to find gaps in our assumptions as soon as we put things into the world. So how can we create things that then allow us to adapt to the changing atmosphere around them, I think is a big, big question.
Carissa, what do you envisage for the future of our cities? And we're kind of reinventing our cities now.
Yeah, building off Scott's note on aiming for imperfection is, how can we allow for more imagination within the spaces that we're creating? And I don't know if I know how to do this. But the reality is, with things like infrastructure that are put into place and are very solid for so many years, the lifespan of a building is X number of years, things like our technology move much faster, shift a lot quicker than the pace of our infrastructure. And yet the pace of our changing climate, which used to be much slower, is now speeding up in response. And so how do, you know, how are we going to imagine and have that versatility to deal with the imperfections that come when the pace of reality is very much out of sync with itself? I don't really know the answer to it, but what are ways that we can be creative with our policies, with our systems of government, things that currently operate really slowly, but could have more in the way of faster responses to how we deal with the changing constraints around us? I think like that's one place for innovation that I think would really help the climate. That we had the Inflation Reduction Act, right, which is the largest climate bill ever passed. How does that trickle down to our local communities, our local governments, our more of our spheres of control? I feel like that's the next place that I'd be excited for innovation.
So how can you talk about design within government, talking about how we can make our cities more imaginative? And so how can we further develop our political process so it's more responsive and not just, you know, these regular election cycles, but really responsive? And when you can identify, say, we're talking about cities, but it can be anything. This isn't working. I have an insight into how it could work and how that can be communicated, that it's more direct and responsive and customized to how we live now.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think neither of us are, say, political scientists, but I will say to Carissa's point about pace, we have an assumption that technological innovation outpaces government regulation. That's a very well-founded assumption because that's how it goes. Like, it's always been that way. However, I think we need to start thinking differently, and we should be able to imagine that we can create legislation that precedes the impacts of the things we're creating. So if we see a potential effect coming, we should be able to put in a sort of preemptive law, I think, to be able to address it prior to the effect actually happening, which we do in a lot of ways. There's tons of examples of that. But I think basically the pace of legislation needs to accelerate so that it can really grapple with the pace of technological innovation. But then if you do that, you have to be ready for the fact that that legislation might be off, right? It's speculative. It's anticipatory. You're not necessarily going to get it right. So I think we also need to build in mechanisms into the laws that make them responsive and changeable. So let's have a speculative legislation. We'll put a law out there, a regulation that's speculative, but let's have built-in checks that are constantly checking, like, is this working the way we wanted it to? And it needs to be easy to change if it's not, which is also not built into the system. So I think like we need to be able to imagine things working in ways in which we aren't used to them working. And one, I think, is legislation being quick and responsive. When generally it's sort of slow and hard to change. That's one thing that I could really think could help.
Yes. And you spoke earlier about social media being the public square and social media not actually behaving in the way in which it was initially designed, all sorts of other uses and abuses arising out of it. So how could that be a part of that responsive process or testing the water of the public discourse or affecting change in legislation? Or what could be put in place to, I mean, it's not a kind of social media, but it would behave in a similar way. What kind of checks and balances could be put onto it, kind of guardrails, so that it doesn't behave in the way social media is behaving now?
I mean, you could put trial periods on pieces of legislation. We could have one thing, you know, Scott and I like to kick around imaginative ideas for types of legislation, right? One idea is like a look both ways technology, where let's say we have a big new social media like technology that's about to be launched, and AI and all sorts of algorithms, like that would fit within that bucket. Is there a moment where there's a trial period with technologies like that, where we have some ideas as to how they might need to be governed, that we could put those in place and then use that, say, 2-year period of time when that technology is learning how it's going to actually work once it's in place? And we both look historically, looking back, look that way, and see, like, how have other technologies similar to this affected our world? What should we be looking for in terms of the effects that it might be having both on our individual persons as well as our societies? And then to also look the other way, like look forward, do some visioning as to what might come to pass 10, 20, 30 years down the road if this technology continues to propagate into the future. Now, how does that all happen? Again, like, we don't know. We're not those types of political scientists, but it does feel like we need people pushing and being really thinking of how can we change the pace of legislation. So not to stifle innovation, but to allow us to be careful and really notice the effects that it may possibly have.
Yes, these are some of the intangibles and actionables that you write about.
Yeah, the intangibles are really about what are those forces that are coming together that are making this moment feel quite unsettling. And those being the fact that everything is interconnected and flows between each other and the feelings that you were talking about before, as well as our human propensity to make stories and make believe and come up with narratives to connect ideas, whether they exist or not, the very human characteristics. And our actionables are like, what are ways to like notice those forces that are happening, to see the unseen so that each one of us can be more aware of what's happening and build the world for the better.
We have another idea in the book that's about the fact that the way we see things as people, just, you know, the way our brains work is not really indicative of how the world works. There's a reason for that. Us being able to pay attention to certain things and ignore others allows us to navigate. But it shouldn't be mistaken for an understanding or holistic view of the world. There's a concept that we talk about in the book called the Umwelt. And the idea of an Umwelt is it's what your senses can take in. And all different species have different. So as an example, cockroaches sense movement in a way that we don't. Butterflies can see infrared light and we can't. Butterflies can actually taste with their feet, which is kind of an amazing thing. And I'm kind of glad that we don't, frankly. But the point is that just even through our senses, and you can talk about that in terms of everything, right? My understanding of a situation is going to be different than your understanding of a situation. The way I think of a story of what happened is going to be different than the way you thought of a story. And there's a man named Gregory Bateson, who is an environmentalist. And he talks about how most of the problems in the world are actually a problem between the way people think and how the world works. And they're not the same thing. So the way we understand the world and how that world actually works is just not mapped perfectly. And that kind of leads to problems because we don't know exactly what we're doing in the world. We can't see all the repercussions of the things we create until later on. One silver lining, though, about the technologies that we're creating is that technologies like AI could be used to help us with this issue, with the fact that our mental models aren't exactly in line with how the world works. So AI is actually very good at predicting, at modeling outcomes. It could be used to understand climate change better so that we're able to understand that in a way that allows us to act. It could also help us predict the impacts of the things that we're making. So there's a bit of a silver lining in here, even though it can feel scary to be in a situation where your mental model and how the world works are not in line.
Yeah, it's so interesting. We distort things and have our machines translate the world back to us. It's a strange world. Anyway.
It is a strange world. That's the thing. It's a strange world.
Those are the positive applications, of course. There's a reason why the EU AI Act and AI Acts all over the world in different degrees, and militarized AIs, medicines that can be created by AI, but also bioterrorism. Reflecting on all those challenges and the risks and the guardrails that we need to put in place and whether they're effective or not when it's, as you say, a runaway technology, as you reflect on AI, how do you feel it's going to change the future of education, the future of work, the way it's changing, the way we communicate with ourselves and our imaginations and talk about perception, even the way we perceive ourselves, our sense of self, as all these things change, that's changing as well. So what are your broader reflections on this vast topic?
Well, one is it's absolutely going to change us. I think the sooner that we can be very proactive, I'll say too, I don't know if I want to be changed. And I think a lot of people are feeling that too, but it is going to change us. And so it's not going to help to pretend like it's not happening. But I do think we can all be very proactive in noticing the changes it's having on us, on our children, on our planet, and from every scale, from that like large system-wide, you know, energy footprint scale, all the way down to, I won't even call it minuscule, but like, I worry that AI is changing my thoughts and can control my thoughts. And that, you know, used to sound really far-fetched and now sort of like maybe middle of the road, but I guarantee like in a year's time that will sound like a very normal concern, because the reality is we are being, if you think about the phenomena of social listening, is very, very sophisticated. And this is the idea that all of the data in the websites that we visit, the data trails that we leave out in the world, are tracking us, our locations and our behaviors and our habits, such that there are many sites out there that can predict exactly what we're thinking and feeling and feed us advertising content or things that aren't even advertising content that can change what our next behaviors are.
And you mentioned social listening there. And for those who don't know, social listening is actually listening tools used by Meta, Google, and others. They're kind of brands' eyes and ears online. They can continuously scan the web and flag anything important related to your activity, keywords that then target you. And in terms of AI, I think we're seeing how we've farmed out creative and critical thinking to a manic black box spewing out stuff. And we're still in the early days. It's not hard to see down the line to a time when we'll have such sophisticated AI assistants that we won't even need reflective thoughts anymore. And if we so choose, we'll be communicating with our AI assistant and effectively removing human communication. And this technology is very proficient in getting to the unemotional core of each other's needs. But what are we losing along the way?
And I think that's getting more and more sophisticated. And I think, like, in a world where we have already seen our political elections be affected by mass attacks on our social media, et cetera, like, when that comes down to our individual agency and behavior, I think that that's something that we do need to be concerned about. The way that we as individuals can combat it is to be aware that it's happening, right? Like, is to really start to notice the unnoticed. And I still feel really optimistic amongst this concern.
I think that it's not far-fetched to say we know that we have been living for a long time in a kind of digital smog, which I speculate that affects us just the way it affects birds and affects animals and our ability to, it's in our environment. And then if you just look at the way AI behaves and spits out answers and, you know, products in a brilliant, fast-paced way, it's also kind of manic. And I mean, maybe not influencing our direct line-by-line thoughts, but being in an atmosphere of mania can influence you, I would say.
Well, and it comes out looking true, right? It comes out like indiscernible from the actual truth, right? If the search results generated by an AI are literally in the exact same font, right, then the ones that are created from searching the web, like the level of resolution is identical, right? It's really hard to discern. When we are prototyping new design ideas with students, we love this mantra that the prototype should never be more resolved than the idea. So like if you want to make a new chair and you're really just like concerned with how much space it should take up, you make that thing out of cardboard so that you just get an idea of space. You don't make it at its final beautiful wood and leather resolution, because then you're going to be looking at like, does this texture feel right? You're not going to be thinking about the amount of space it's taking up. But with AI, like, you're right, that manicness, that hallucinations, when they appear exactly the same as something that we are used to as just this like representation of search, et cetera, that's very confusing. That is confusing to our brains. And if you're working quickly, you can miss it.
You mentioned digital smog, Mia, and something Carissa and I have been talking about lately is as you move from the industrial era to a media era, the landscape of what we're working with changes. So in a media landscape, the environment is not just the trees and the water and the air. It's actually our minds. You know, it's our emotions and it's our feelings and it's our mental models and it's our imagination. And so our brains are kind of the environment in which all these new media updates and designs are playing out. Where does pollution show up? Pollution shows up in political polarization. It shows up in difficulties with mental health. And I think we need to think of our imagination in a media space as a public resource that needs to be protected. It's like our collective imagination, the sum total of our individual imaginations and how they affect each other is really important to start thinking about with a conservation mindset.
This is like this kind of silent spring moment of the media era.
So in a world dominated by AI, is capitalism, do you feel, designed to evolve to a more, you know, equitable social economic order? I mean, we're talking about the future of work and these things, or will it perpetuate you know, its contradictions leading to further, you know, exploitation and inequality.
I'm not an economist, but I think you can see signals in both directions. There is consolidations of power, particularly around media, and you see monopolistic behavior, and there are plenty of downsides. You can also see it in sort of the shift in the way politics is moving. At the same time, there is a lot of consciousness expanding around where we could be going. There's an economist at Oxford named Kate Raworth, who I really admire, and just has a beautiful model of where we could be going. And the basic idea is that we can do whatever we need to do, but there are limits on the top and on both ends, right? One limit is that we have to be able to preserve a thriving planet. And the other limit is that people need to thrive as well. So as long as we're meeting those two things, we can build any economic model that's going to help us achieve what we need to achieve within those constraints. And her point is that we probably need to morph into a new model. Like, why are we still working on models that are hundreds of years old? I think it's time for something really different.
Yes, and I do want to say, as much as you're discussing these future technologies or the ones that were, you know, being designed at the present moment, that your book, we should honor the beautiful illustrations by Armando Veve. It's so beautiful, and you know, it's a really a celebration of the handmade, and also I feel of the slowness of design thinking. I mean, we have to take our time to get things right.
One more backstory on those illustrations is that those were all created by Armando in his actual brain. And so if you look at the chapter openers for each chapter, there's this beautiful hand-drawn graphite illustration. And that illustration is an amalgamation of things that happen in the fiction stories in that chapter. And then if you look at the beautiful full spread part openers, there's two of those for parts one and two. Each of those is this huge scene. In that scene are all things that happen in the nonfiction elements of that part. And he had just envisioned those out of what was happening in a way that Scott and I could have never predicted, right? Or even asked for. In working with an illustrator that talented was just such a gift.
To add to that, you know,
even though AI can generate images so quickly, that's not really the point. The point is to create things and see what people can do and dazzle each other. And working with our illustrator was amazing because we had such a close relationship with him as he created the work. We were able to really explore ideas, and the output is just fantastic. It is so tuned to what the book is, but also so surprising. And it's not really just about that output. It's about the process of creating that, the thinking that goes into that, and how that shows up in the expression and transfers to people who might be reading the book. So really, when we're talking about design. So often it feels like we're looking for something that's very efficient, that will serve a need and just kind of pop out an end product. But there's so much more to it than even just the drawings, even though the drawings are spectacular.
Yeah, people forget that about design. So often we are looking for something that's hyper efficient or serves a need, or it's a sleek design object, but it's those human stories or animal stories, whatever goes into the design thinking and the problems that are identified. Otherwise, if we were just completely logical and efficient, I don't know, maybe AI would come to the solution about us that maybe we don't need humans on the planet. You know, we don't need it. We could just do without them. They've made a mess. So it's about the lives, the creative process. How do you stimulate within your classrooms, within your writing process, how you work together to write the book? You know, what is your creative process?
Well, we could talk about the process of writing this book, because it was really very mind expanding, very challenging, and also really rewarding. So one thing that was really wild as we were doing that, you know, deciding what the book was going to be, is that this is over the course of the last 3 to 4 years was our process of knowing it's happening to writing. It's like, that's when we've seen this huge AI, especially climate acceleration, especially shift. And, you know, both technologically and impacts in the environment and in the public psyche too. So things that we were writing about that felt really futuristic to us really started to come true. And so in a book where we were trying to both map out what is, but also paint pictures of what might be through the speculative fiction, it was pretty fascinating and sometimes discouraging when then you read a news article about that fictional idea having already come to pass. And so like that rapid acceleration of change that we're in felt very real to us throughout this process.
Yes. And Scott, what are some of the designs or inventions that you're most excited about that you would like to see implemented or are coming down the pipeline?
Yeah, well, I mean, two things. One, we were talking about earlier when we were talking about Armando and the work that we did with him, is that so much of design now is not just about the output. It's about how the output gets created. And I think that's a good change. Not that it hasn't been happening, but it seems to be there's more consciousness around it. So we cite a few things in the book. There's an architect who just won the Pritzker Prize a couple of years ago named Francis Carré. And so he creates these beautiful buildings that are very needed. They're hospitals and schools in Burkina Faso. And he does them, the way he does them, though, is as great as the things he produces. So he goes in, he trains people to build the buildings. He uses materials that are locally available so that it's not just that they have a building, but the people who work with him now know how to build a building. And so that's like the idea that actually the creating of the thing isn't as important as the output of the thing. So one is just the shift toward that type of consciousness and design, I think, is really important, regardless of what we make. And then on the other hand, I mean, you know, we're going to have to feed 10 billion people by 2060, I think, is the estimate.
We work with a synthetic biologist named Drew Endy, who has an idea that we can move from manufacturing, the way we manufacture now, we have parts and pieces and industrial machines, to something that looks a lot more like growing. So he has an idea that you could actually grow a house, right? You could genetically program a tree or wood to kind of grow into a house. I don't know if that's possible, but it brings up a really fascinating idea that we could move from a manufacturing economy to a much more organic growing economy. Like, what's that going to do? There are scary things about that. We're manipulating genetic material. We got to be careful. But it's also just this amazing thought of we could be living in a totally different paradigm, and that paradigm could completely upend all the issues that we have now. So, of course, we have to be careful at what new issues it would create. But just the idea of being able to imagine that we could create differently brings up the idea that it's not just what we put out into the world, but it's how we create those things, how we put those things out into the world that really matter. Because, you know, their existence, the things that we design, is only a moment in time, but their creation involves everything. It involves how we work together, what materials we have, and what we create. So it seems really amazing, but it also brings up its own questions.
Oh, I love that idea. I mean, this book is full of wonderful ideas and very empowering. And I love thinking about the future of food because, of course, we have to, you know, how do we feed ourselves? But also this kind of somewhat high-tech agrarian future. It's really exciting. We all moved away from farming. Now we're kind of like going back to it within a different way.
Yeah, we can really manipulate things in such a way that like they can be a lot more efficient, a lot more healthy, fit into that circular economy in a better way. Now, again, there is this downside where we're speeding up evolution. We don't know what's going to happen there. And, you know, the bad actor thing and all that. But just the ability to imagine that there's a different way to do what we're doing. You know, I'm always struck by the first car that was mass produced was an electric Porsche in like 1896. You know, we had electric car, like we could have gone that way, right? Even know about. And we can get there. You know, we have to be careful, but there's some beautiful things that are hiding in the solutions that we've already made.
We have an example in the book about bananas and as an exemplar of the monoculture that is pervasive in our food systems today. The quick synopsis of it is that the majority of the bananas in the world are of this one variety called Cavendish. And that specific variety is great at transport. You can pick it green enough so that it arrives on your shelf and it will just ripen to yellow and not be bruised. And it tastes okay, right? So it's like this combo of really great at traveling the globe and, you know, good enough passable to taste-wise. And the really neat piece of this is that bananas reproduce primarily by cloning. And so they are genetic copies of each other. So when something like a virus or a fungus attacks our crops that are monoculture, it takes them down really quickly. And this has happened to our bananas in the past. There was a previous type of banana called the Big Mike banana that was the one that was pervasive around the planet, taken down by a fungal rot called Panama disease. And so Cavendish bananas, the ones we eat today, were a response to one monoculture. We created another one in response to it. And now there's a new strain of Panama disease that's coming for these bananas again. And so this idea makes it easy to transport food places if it's very predictable. However, it also makes us not resilient to change. Now you have places in both hemispheres that are working to diversify the population of bananas and in many other foods, right? Because the more biodiversity we have, the more resilience that we all have too.
Indeed, sometimes we have to respect that with a good design, it already exists. We have to recognize there's some things we can't improve upon.
Absolutely.
So just in closing, tell us about the mission of the Stanford D School, the Hasso-Plattner Institute of Design, and how it's become a kind of incubator for many interesting projects like this.
Yeah, our mission is really to help people with their own ingenuity be able to create a world that's worth living in for them, the people around them, and all of us. And so what we focus on is what we call design, which is really the act of bringing an idea into the world in a way that's desirable. So we work with students both in a degree program and from around the university. So like in the School of Engineering, the School of Education, School of Law, School of Business. And they come to create things that will change things. So as an example, we had some students a couple years ago working on something that looks a lot like a product, sounds like design, a musical instrument that teaches you how to play music. And then we have other students who really dive into these complex systems. So we had a duo last year who was working on a way to change the way that palm oil is produced. Palm oil is one of these oils that's just absolutely everywhere. A lot of people make a living off of it. There are farmers who make their whole living off of it. And also it just has huge environmental impact. So looking at ways to rethink the way palm oil is produced so that both the farmers benefit and the environment benefits. And that's just a huge problem.
So as you think about the future, the importance of good design, the importance of creativity and the beauty of the natural world and the kind of planet that we're leaving for the next generation, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
I have two things maybe. One is when you're thinking about a creative field or just even bringing creativity to whatever field you have, creativity is often about like finding the hidden thing, finding the thing that nobody else is seeing and taking it to reality. And so like not to think that make-believe or imagination or weird ideas are not worth it. Like I had some mentors in my life that just allowed me to understand how you should take make-believe seriously. Because if you go down this kind of wild path, you find something that's beyond what's going on, and eventually the world is going to make it normal and it's going to integrate it. Otherwise, it just like won't work. So don't worry about being out there. Like we need people to be thinking beyond what is toward what could be. I think that's number one. And the second thing is that the way you do things is as important as the things you do. So it's not just about the product. It's about how you do it, because how you do it actually has more repercussions sometimes than the product. You know, you might create a great product, but everyone who's working on it is angry, and the people you're trying to serve aren't excited about it, or they've been taken advantage of to be able to make it come into the world. And that leaves more bad stuff that's a little harder to see, but has an equal or bigger impact. So just how you make it is as important as what you make.
I'll add two more on top. One is to be a multi-subject learner. So the way that we take in information, it varies by field of study, right? The way that a computer works on a problem and thinks about how the pieces come together are very different than a historian, very different than somebody that studies the Mandarin language, right? The more ways of problem solving that you can ingest, the more tools you have at hand, the more opportunity you're going to see in the overlaps between those disciplines. So try on many different subjects, if only to understand people that pursue those fields think about challenges. And then the second one is that more and more slowness needs to be a deliberative act. And we need to really impress upon young people that you can unplug, you can take yourself out of the fray. I read this morning the old Nokia brick phone is officially coming back. And like that gives me hope that there are going to be built-in ways to allow that slowness to happen. But the more places that we can allow our young people to do that in their own lives, the happier, the more at peace we're going to be.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure talking to you both. Important messages. I agree. We live in a garden of possibilities, and there's so much unlocked potential. We just have to give ourselves permission to make believe we can make those things real and make even our imperfections part of that process. So thank you, Scott Durley and Carissa Carter, for your inspiring and empowering message by expanding our appreciation of design, its importance as a vehicle for environmental and social change. We can assemble a better tomorrow. Thank you for adding your voice to the Creative Process and One Planet podcast.
Thank you for having us, Mia. It's been great to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
The Creative Process and One Planet podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interviews producers on this episode were Katie Foster and Soraya Fofana. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.